Welcome to Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Join us for an in-depth look at Iowa agriculture. Here are your hosts, Dustin Hoffman and Anna Hastert.
And welcome back to another edition of Weekend Ag Matters here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. I'm your host this week, Dustin Hoffman, alongside Anna Hastert. And, of course, want to welcome a few new affiliates on to the network as well for the Weekend Ag Matters program. So we thank them for tuning in. So if you're hearing this for the first time, well, thanks for joining us. Kind of a busy week this week. You were on the road for a couple of days in and out of there. Tell us a little bit about what you had going on.
Yeah, so I don't think I mentioned this in last weekend's program, but last Friday I was on the road. I had headed to Kelowna, Iowa, to meet with the channel agronomist as well as the channel seedsman. A really interesting trip that I took and a lot of useful information that I collected there. We were just talking about the growing season and what we're looking at heading into harvest here, what we can expect maybe from yields from that area, as well as some of the challenges that we faced aside from weather. You know, tar spot was something that they really struggled with this year. That has kind of made it spread all across the state. It's really causing some challenges for growers. So looking a little bit more into that and as to why this is causing issues and maybe what things that we can do moving forward to prevent this in fields. And then on Tuesday this week, I went to, around the Cedar Falls area over by Arlington and Olwine and visited with a couple farmers there who are participating in the Iowa Seed Corn Cover Crop Initiative, which is farmers who are implementing cover crops post-seed corn production. So I aired an interview, I think, on Thursday in the Profit Matters program, if you want to go back and listen, with Tim Recker of Arlington, Iowa. He talks about the differences he's seen in two soybean fields. One soybean field didn't have cover crops on it before planting. The other, he planted into some green cereal rye. So he's talking about some yield differences that he's seen in his cover cropped field. So that's really interesting. But Dustin, you were kind of out and about as well this week.
Well, yeah, and of course, my week got interesting on Tuesday. The EPA announced its proposed supplementary rule to the RFS, and, you know, we had this big agreement on October 4th. Everybody had been waiting a long time to find a way that they could reallocate the gallons and make everything work, and an EPA came out with this rule 11 days later, and it seemed to completely do a 180 on everything that the agreement had reached, and that they weren't doing what the president said was going to get done. Of course, this drew the ire of several Iowa-based and national-based agriculture and biofuel supporter organizations, and I also had the chance to talk with Senator Ernst. In fact, I was supposed to talk with her anyway, and then about 40 minutes before we were going to talk, this dropped, so we had a few minutes to talk about that as well. And so there's a comment period. Senator Ernst, of course, urging everybody to make comments heard during that time. And of course, we had the World Food Prize going on. A big thing that they were talking about this year here in Des Moines was, you know, trying to bring everybody together to work for the benefit of growing food for this population that's growing. We have agriculturists who maybe need to change a few practices here and there or change some bigger practices depending on how you're operating. And you have environmentalists who seem to always want to combat and get really aggressive about it. And they're saying this altercation, this headbutting is not doing any good. What we need to do is bring these groups together, find a way for everybody to understand each other's goals and needs and abilities and be able to take those and move forward and how to integrate new technologies to make this work. So that was a big deal as well. So tell us about the segment you got coming up.
Yeah, so in conjunction with the World Food Prize, America's Cultivation Corridor hosted a press conference talking about how Iowa can better connect with other countries who are looking to Iowa as a leader in agriculture. So I'm just going to turn it over here to Charles Sukup, who tells us a little bit more about this new initiative.
Iowa leads the nation in various aspects of agricultural production. For example, Iowa leads the nation in egg production, ranks second in soybean production, and has the third largest number of farms. So it should come as no surprise that other countries look to our great state as an example. America's Cultivation Corridor this week launched a groundbreaking initiative which builds on Iowa's global leadership in agriculture. Charles Sukup, board chairman for America's Cultivation Corridor, spoke to the new initiative at a press conference Wednesday.
Cultivo Global Ag Innovation Program is a 10-day immersion program. There'll be groups of international startup companies and entrepreneurs to Iowa to learn and connect from business professionals, researchers, and farmers. The program will include a full slate of training in U.S. regulatory and financial systems, as well as how to develop a business and funding pitch for North American markets. Participants will have opportunities to visit and engage with world-renowned researchers at Iowa State University and with leading-edge farmers and livestock producers. We particularly think in the fall here that there's nothing more exciting than taking an international people and giving them a ride on the combine and seeing the productivity of Iowa agriculture. Each session will conclude with a pitch day event, providing each startup participant the opportunity to present their company to global industry leaders, world-leading research faculty, investors, and venture capitalists. In our board meeting, we particularly talked about today the importance of bringing in and linking the venture capitalists with the new ideas, research, and startups that we have going. The program will be coordinated by America's Cultivation Corridor with key partners including Iowa State University, the Iowa AgriTech Accelerator, Iowa State Papa John's Center, Iowa State Agricultural Entrepreneurship Institute, and Iowa's Commodity Group Leaders. Each 10-day program will feature a cohort of 5 to 10 startup companies from the same country. And we've got 4 countries right now in the pool, not quite sure which one will be first. We expect to finalize the first country and cohort members in the near future, with plans to host the first cohort in spring 2020. We're extremely pleased with the level of interest that we've had so far. Iowa not only has established a leadership position in global agriculture and bioscience, but also developed a strong and innovative ecosystem for agriculture startups and entrepreneurs. The diversity of Iowa's agricultural industry makes it the perfect place to host an immersion program that will connect startups with leaders in their business focus area. I'm excited not only for the opportunities that this will present to startup companies, but also for the potential connections and opportunities for the state of Iowa. By hosting and networking with some of the most innovative minds from around the world, we can strengthen our own research programs and build relationships that could lead to new business opportunities and technologies for growers.
That was Charles Sukup, board chairman for America's Cultivation Corridor, speaking to the Cultivo Global Ag Initiative program, which is designed for global startup companies and entrepreneurs. I'm Anna Hostert with this week in Ag Matters Report. Stay tuned for more news and information.
How many acres are you keeping an eye on? Another pair of eyes could be very helpful in protecting your ROI, especially ones that are highly trained. And that's what you'll get with an FS Crop Specialist. They can spot issues you might not even know you have using the latest technology, including thermal, drone, and NDVI imaging. Then they can get an early treatment plan started. Contact your local FS Crop Specialist to learn more about our crop scouting services. It's one more way FS is bringing you what's next.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters. Here's your host, Dustin Hoffman.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. This week, we had the World Food Prize here in Des Moines. I had a chance to talk to CGIR's Executive Director, Elwin Granger-Jones, about a new initiative they have. Let's listen in.
We're talking today about a new initiative CGIR is announcing here at the World Food Prize. Tell us a little bit about the initiative and what it's working toward.
It's called Crops to End Hunger. It's an initiative that aims to develop with partners a whole new generation of crop varieties, get those into the hands of smallholder farmers so we can produce more, better, more nutritious, more drought resistant, more flood resistant seeds, which is what the world's going to need if we're going to feed ourselves in the future. It's focusing on a whole bunch of crops. We produce or work with our partners to develop varieties in 20 crops. And in there, you've got the staples. So many people still eat those staples across the developing world, whether it's rice or wheat. We've got to make those better. But we've got to make a whole bunch of other crops better as well, whether it's sorghum or other crops. So it's a variety of things. You know, the bottom line is that there's about 500 million smallholder farmers on this planet. They feed half of the world's population, and they're on the front line of climate change. Most of them are relying on rain-fed agriculture. And if we care about security, unplanned migration, chaotic urbanization, we need to get the right things into the hands of these farmers so they can remain viable businesses. And better seed varieties is part of that package of what's needed. There's been a lot of discussion at this conference, where it's great to be back in Des Moines again, I should say. It's becoming an annual visit to this great city. There's been a lot of discussion about climate-positive agriculture. You've had Corteva talking about this in many parts of this globally important meeting. What's key is that agriculture is an essential part of the solution of a sustainable planet. And there are so many opportunities to change approaches in a way that helps farmers produce more, but produce it better and produce it more sustainably. Because we all want to feel good about what we do and make money in the process. Same applies to smallholder farmers. They don't want to be cutting down forests to sustain their family and to do what's called slash and burn. They want to be able to make a living and make it sustainably. And I think the same will apply anywhere. So, yeah, agriculture is one of those areas where there is vast untapped potential to do better and to do it more sustainably and to do it more profitably in the process. We've seen a huge take-up of things like no-till agriculture in this part of the world. Took 10, 15 years to get there. But my, is that working out in terms of yield increases and profitability? And it's great for the planet. And there's many more things like that we can be doing and should be doing. And that's a lot of what's being discussed right here, right now.
You know, and you mentioned even in this area where the uptake of the no-till, you know, there are people that'll say, we've got so far to go, it's unattainable. But if you look at where we were that 10 or 15 years ago, it's progress. It's in going in the right direction.
That's what people say about change. Huh? It feels slow while you're doing it, but when you look back, you think it's incredible. Let's take the world conversation on climate change. Okay, there's lots of setbacks. But we're reaching a point now where if you go to an agriculture meeting, people talk about the weather and they talk about how much less predictable it is, how that's affecting their yields, how it's affecting the pests that they're experiencing. And, you know, that relates back to something called climate change or global warming, whatever you want to call it. And that's just becoming a standard discussion. And that wasn't possible 10 or 15 years ago when this was somewhat left of field and wasn't being discussed. So change happens, change in thinking happens. And what excites me is that the rate of technological progress is so fast that it's giving the tools to deal with the terrible problems we're facing in the world's food system at the same time as those problems are evolving. So we just need to up the speed. And then I think we can make a more sustainable world food system. Let's not forget that the world food system is pretty dysfunctional. It's providing about a third of the world's population with not enough nutrients. And it's providing another third of the population with the wrong kind of foods and healthy foods. We have spiraling obesity, including in developing countries, with enormous personal and public costs. And it's doing this at unsustainable costs to the environment. So we don't want to be the villain of the piece. We want to be the solution.
You know, you bring up the idea of the agriculture being that piece. And I heard that a few times here this morning already, almost like a piece through agriculture, getting people to come together, people and organizations or groups that would normally have been at odds about different sides, whether it's agriculture and environmentalists and all this. But the thing is, getting everybody together and finding that common ground. What's good for the environment? What's good for the producers? And what's good for the people that are needing to be the consumers of this as well?
Yeah, you know, looking back, and it's easy to see things in retrospect, but the 20th century, we were pretty good at putting things in boxes to make sense of them. So we put these things in boxes, I don't know, by commodity. We created research centers by commodity, or we segmented markets and said, here's the market for this. We developed government agencies that dealt with one bit of the picture. And we put things into sectors. You've got the private sector, the government sector. And surprise, surprise, we had piecemeal solutions. And issues like nutrition or environmental degradation are problems because we were not able to solve them because we were addressing things in a piecemeal fashion, and these problems cannot be dealt with in that way. To solve those problems, you need unusual partnerships. You need companies like Corteva, who I just came out of a meeting with them right now about climate positive agriculture with my team. You need civil society. You need government agencies. You need, first and foremost, real farmers who can talk about their needs. And only if we break down these historical boundaries will we be able to solve these problems. And that's why meetings like the World Food Prize are so fascinating, because actually we're all doing a lot of networking with partners that wouldn't sit in our offices. And that's why a research organization like CGIAR, which is the largest global public-funded agricultural research network, there's 10,000 staff in 70 countries working on all aspects of the food system. We're just one part of the innovation chain, principally to get innovations to smallholder farmers. And we've got to work through governments, through private companies, through civil societies, and with farmers. So yeah, it's all about different kinds of partnership, gets us out of these boxes that we contained ourselves in, created in a historical past when we thought the solutions lied in one simple small bit of the picture.
You know, and I've been hearing that today, too. It's not just one simple solution. It's not just one end goal that you can have in mind, because there are so many things interplaying. And we've mentioned, we talked about economics. We talked about environmentalism. We also brought up government. How do you deal with a situation where government is looking at, okay, you have the urban areas. That's where the votes are. That's where the attention needs to be paid. But yet, farmers who are supporting the feeding of the whole world need to be paid attention to as well.
I couldn't agree more on the need to pay attention to farmers, and it's an issue in many developing countries where one has an urban elite and a rural poor, and the rural poor do not always get the priority they need. And that's not great for anybody, because that can lead to situations where you have these really significant parts of the population who are underemployed, are susceptible to all kinds of political challenges, who often move to urban centers, and it can lead to really unplanned migration and urbanization. And so we've got to pay attention to farmers. They might be a small share of the population in somewhere like USA. They're a big share of the population in many developing countries. And the food system is a massive part of every economy. And if you don't have farmers, you don't have a food system, and then you lose a lot. You don't have the jobs that creates, and you have all kinds of political instability if food prices spiral out of control, as they almost did some years ago. And those risks haven't gone away. So a long way of saying we cannot forget farming, and we've got to talk about farming being an anchor to a food system that needs change. And for change, you need governments to be at the table and part of that discussion.
So as we get ready to wrap up today, anything you want to add in closing about the initiative?
We're really excited about it. We feel it's part of a modernization of the whole way that CGIAR and international agricultural research is taking place, to re-equip it for the 21st century. That takes what we did about half a century ago to usher in the Green Revolution, where CGIAR was a pivotal part of that, and updates that for the world we face now, which is more complex, more environmentally challenged, with a climate emergency that needs urgent action. And this is an important part of that package of support, where we need a multilateral response, and we're a multilateral effort.
That again was Elwin Granger-Jones, Executive Director of CGIAR at the World Food Prize in Des Moines. That's it for this segment of Weekend Ag Matters. We'll have Ken Root coming in to wrap things up right after this. Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters. And now, here's Ken Root.
The first time I saw my mother cry, I was so young that only snippets remained in my brain. She was standing by the window with a dish towel in her hands and looking out into the yard. "They are selling the horses," she said as I climbed into a chair and gazed through. I think I remember seeing my brother lead two workhorses onto a pickup truck with stock racks. The truck drove away, and that was the end of an era I only knew through the stories of my parents as they modernized and switched to farming with tractors, but had fond memories of the 30 years of farm life they shared with horses and mules. Orrin and Marie were pretty much frozen in time from the late 1920s until World War II ended. I was a late-in-life child, as they had two grown sons and a 10-year-old daughter when I came along in 1949. The mental scar of the Depression was deep for these two Okies, who went through the coldest, dirtiest, and hottest decade of the century in the short history of the state. Having only a wagon and team when they married and started sharecropping in 1929, the only thing they had to show for it in 1939 was three children and a few pieces of worn-out machinery. The times were so tough, they said, that cars bought in the 20s were parked as they couldn't afford gas or tires. The only alternative to walking was riding a horse or a mule. Dad bought two mules during the period, and later on, a team of horses. This accounting came from my sister. Our team of mules were named Bobby and Jack. Bobby was sweet, and I think we rode her under Mother's supervision. Bobby was the stay-at-home type, but Jack must have missed his old home, because I believe he ran off twice and went back to the Kearney area about 20 miles away. Dad tracked him, then rode him home. I guess Dad was on foot. He said he was on the road at night and stopped and asked some people if he could sleep there, once in a barn and once on the porch or floor of their home. These animals were the mainstay of the era. They were the only pulling power a farmer had to mow hay or plow a field. Dad had a one-bottom plow that was 12 inches wide. My brother and I computed the minimum distance he and the mule had to walk to plow 1 acre of land. It was 8.25 miles. Counting turning around at the end rows, it was well over 11. The reason for small farms was obvious with those numbers. When the tractor came along, farmers saw it as a means to cover more land more easily. Dad's first tractors, a Fordson and a Farmall F-12, were superior to horses. So why did my mother cry when the horses left the farm? It was clearly a bond with the animals that was not there with the machine. My sister related the horses' names were Daisy and Florrie, and were cared for year-round whether they worked or not. A day in the field required watering and resting the animals, and when they were put back into the barn at the end of the day, they were cooled down, fed, and combed or curried so they could work again the next day. It was a symbiotic relationship that lasted for the lifetime of the animal, and sometimes generationally, from one farmer to the next. We would hear stories about how stubborn a mule could be and the intelligence of a good workhorse. Florrie would hold her foot up when we stopped so she wouldn't crush the tomato plants we were cultivating, according to my mother as she sang the praises of the team. But she had few kind words for Jack the mule, as he was difficult to manage. Dad would say, "You could not work Jack to death, as he was too smart to let you do it. He would stop and stand you off until he was ready to go again." It is good to see draft horses haven't been totally lost to history. They opened up our country, and it would be a shame to let them slip away. Imagine the time that all conveyances were pulled by horses. The city streets had a different sound and smell as they made their deliveries each day. Now we sit in trucks and tractor cabs that insulate us from the world. The modern machine is so complex we can only fuel it, check the gauges, and hope it runs until the next trip to a high-tech shop for electronic examination. Interestingly, we still rate our engines in horsepower, even though only an engineer can tell you the foot-pound formula. Sometimes a tractor won't start, but a horse or mule only required a harness to begin the slow process of plowing or hauling. The challenge for the driver was that he or she had to be an active participant in the process. Pulling the reins and hollering gee and haw was the equivalent of turning the steering wheel on a tractor. It was an era that required millions of farmers to raise millions of acres of hay and grain just to feed the tens of millions of draft animals needed to do the work. It all sounds romantic, but the power of steel could not be held back for sentimental reasons. The workhorse was replaced, and the farms expanded. Still, the memories, even though they aren't our own, remain. I'm Ken Root on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Thank you, Ken, and that's all for this edition of Weekend Ag Matters. We thank you for tuning in with us here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. You can find replays of this show as well as all of our other content online at iowaagnet.com. Don't forget to find us on Twitter and Facebook at Iowa Ag Radio. On behalf of myself, Anna Hastert, and Ken Root, we thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on Weekend Ag Matters.